Welcome back to another episode of the Exterminatus Podcast, your one-stop shop for all things competitive in the world of Warhammer 40,000. With me is my co-host, Ray.
Hello, everyone.
And my other co-host, Don.
Hey.
And this week we have a special guest star, the winner of the Broadside Bash 2018, Daniel Olivas.
Glad to be here.
Glad to have you on. And we've got a rocking show this week. Ton of news from Games Workshop. Of course, the SoCal Open. We're going to go over that in great depth. And then, of course, leading up to what might be the winter break right before Las Vegas Open. Hopefully, we'll have some updates later in the show from the ITC in terms of the ITC Top 10. But in the meantime, let's break into some of the news. First of all, orcs. We started them last episode. The rest of the clans have come out. What are you guys' thoughts?
I still think snake bites are my favorite one by far because of their utility, and they actually solve your problem of dying in droves to bolters. At least
I
a little bit better.
I have not looked at all.
Well, the good thing is the community page actually put a big all-in-one spot, so you can find them all in one location. Real quick, Don, the snake bites, they have what, feel no pain on 6-up?
Yep, they're feeling pain 6-up, and their stratagem is plus one
target,
wound big things.
It's mini doom, basically.
Yep.
That's pretty handy.
Because it affects army-wide, yeah. Brutal.
Yeah, that's pretty handy.
Yep, and it's usable in shooting and fight phase. So
I have to admit, I'm a little partial. I still like the bad moons, the rerolling ones to hit. It's a ton of dice. You usually have large units with a lot amount of shots, but also it's kind of handy because a lot of their big guns are usually like only one or two shots, so the fact that you get that crappy one, you get another chance to get another hit downfield, so I was pretty excited to see that.
The Death Skulls, is it Death Skulls that get Daka 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 on fives, and then you mob up the Ludas, right? So you have 25 Ludas, Daka 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 on fives, is pretty bonkers as well. That's going to be an interesting combo.
That is bonkers.
Shooting at minus to hit armies, they're going to be more effective than Space Marines by a large margin, which is nuts. More effective than BS3 armies is a BS5 army, which is kind of crazy.
You guys were talking a little bit about some of the new artillery pieces, some of the rule changes there. Tell us a little more about that.
Yeah, it looks like tractor cannons are going to be pretty insane if you're a flyer vehicle. Auto hit, ridiculous range, strength, ridiculous. I think 8 or 9. Don, was it 8 or 9?
I think it's 8.
8 minus 4 and D6 damage. And if you have the fly rule and you're a vehicle, it has the melta rule. So bye-bye, Eldar Flyers. That whole thing of Venoms being invincible is going to not work so good anymore for me.
Yeah, it's pretty nasty all around. And an added fun was a kind of a surprise. Looted wagons are supposed to make a comeback, not in the Codex, but chapter approved, which, can believe it or not, is a month away. It kind of snuck up on me.
Is it coming out? Oh, just beginning of December, or in December sometime? Do we know when?
They basically said in the latest White Dwarf that it should be out next month. So the fact that it's right around the corner, which makes me kind of wonder, why didn't they just put it in the Codex? I don't get it. But
yeah,
I never know the whole... There's all kinds of rumors and explanations. So how long does it really take to, from creation to print, how long it takes to make a Codex? And maybe this missed the deadline. Who knows? But yeah, looted wagons are supposed to make a comeback as well. And so lots of neat stuff for orcs. Overall, what are your thoughts in terms of how this is going to change the meta?
I don't know that they're meta changing. I think it's pretty typical of people getting excited because they're going to be good again for the first time in a while. It'll definitely counter some armies and it'll make people have to be a little more balanced. But I don't know that you're going to see, you know, orcs taking top tables every tournament because they still have a lot of problems. And I don't think the Codex, from what I've seen so far, solves some of their, you know, more difficult problems, which is scoring in ITC especially, which is, you know, table control with something other than bodies. And so many armies are so good at pulling bodies off the table that you just can't rely on model count at this point to score those points. And then I haven't seen enough about their characters other than the war boss on trike to make me think that their characters are gotten better enough to where that's still not a huge weak point for their army. So I think they're going to be better, and I'm happy because I love playing orcs, and I think they're going to be specifically better against my army, Eldar, but I don't think they're going to be, you know, rattling to the meta.
Right.
And I agree with that.
Do we know how many wounds that Warbok boss on Tricycle has?
I don't recall it off the top of my head.
Yeah, I'm going to guess six. He would go six, right? Usually you go on a bike, you get plus one toughness, plus one wound. But it's,
yeah,
but
that's a really big bike. So yeah, maybe I'm more thinking, sure. I'm thinking more like Logan on his chariot, which is 12.
Oh, you think it's going to be that? Really?
Yeah.
That'll be a bummer because then you just snipe him off the table because he doesn't have character protection anymore.
Yep. Right.
Oh, that'll be a big problem. I didn't even think about that. Hopefully it's 9 then. If they did that, hopefully it's 9 because 9 would be better than 12, ironically, in the current game.
Yeah.
One would only hope. So, orcs weren't the only news that Games Workshop released. A little fun from Forge World. It's been a while since Necrons got a little bit of love from the Resin Masters. And sure enough, they got, did you need a Castellan for a Xenos army? Here you go. So the Canoptic Construct is, for lack of a better, they need to come up with a better name.
Yeah, Seraptech Heavy Construct.
Yep.
Yeah.
One thing to keep in mind is it's not Canoptic. If it was Canoptic, it would be even more bonkers than it already is. Because then it would gain the ability to use the stratagem that allows it to advance, shoot, and charge.
Yeah, that would be bad. So let's get into this thing. Like I said, pretty much a Necron Castellan, but it has its own Necron flavor to it.
And I would even go further than that. It's like a Necron Castellan had a baby with a Necron Gallant.
Yeah, that's how I would describe it. Yeah.
It is absolutely crazy how much damage and durability that this model has.
So in case you didn't see it, it's actually on the Warhammer community page. So durability, it is toughness 8, 28 wounds. You're probably like, okay, big deal. It's just like any other knight. But it also has a living metal rule. So for those of you who are not up to your latest Necron rules, it automatically heals one wound per turn when it's activated. And I believe with the Cryptic, adds and changes that to D3, and then you can always put a Canoptic Spider there to do his additional repair job.
Yep, and for the Cryptek, the war gear you'd have to take is the Surfing Cryptek on the Scarab. That's the one that allows it to living metal D3 instead of just one.
So the other fun part about this thing is, unlike other knights, which are allowed to fall back over infantry models, this thing's allowed to not only fall back, but just flat out move over infantry and swarm models. And with a starting movement value of 16 inches, it's going to get places.
Yeah, bonkers fast, faster than Imperial Knights. Like you said, can't be move blocked by infantry or swarms, and also is dynasty capable, which will make it, you know, obviously pick your dynasty. Don's better at that than me for Necrons, but he's got a pretty good idea of what dynasty you're going to run these things as.
Yep, and the dynasty that I like the most is the Novak one, which is when you get charged or heroic intervene, you reroll all failed hits in the fight phase. And that's because this thing puts out a whole lot of damage.
So let's get into that real play. There's two basic configurations. Both are the same number of points. And interesting, both are the same amount of money from your local Forge World provider. The first one is the Singularity Generator. It's a 36-inch range weapon. So he has two of these, one on each side. It is heavy 3d3 shots, strength 8, AP minus 3, d6 damage each. And each time you roll a 6, the target suffers a mortal wound in addition to any additional damage.
That's two wound rolls, by the way.
Yeah, wound rolls of 6, additional mortal.
Wound rolls of 6, yeah. Yes.
Like a sniper, basically. Right. Big giant sniper gun.
And that is a 36-inch gun.
And I like the 3d3 because it eliminates some of the variability that you would normally get from like a 2d6 or a, you know, it just, you're going to get at least a minimum number of shots that you can count on.
And just to reiterate, that does have two of those. So it's 6d3 shots.
Yep. Right. Additionally, in close combat, it has titanic forelimbs. So it has nothing to do with Vince Arroyo's forearms. These actually are quite nasty. Has a Reaping Sweep, which is Strength User, which happens to be Strength 8, by the way. Minus 2 AP, D3 damage each, and you make 3 to-hit rolls for each attack made with this weapon. So this is your happy feet attack.
Yep, stomp with base attacks of 6, which is better even than a gallant. So that's 18 if you're using your stomps, which is brutal.
Yep, at strength 8. Yep.
But in case you're looking for something a little bit more punchy, you have the Impaling Strike. It's still a melee weapon, but it's strength times 2, so bringing you up to strength 16. AP minus 4, a flat 6 damage. That's right, not D6, 6.
Flat 6.
No roll required.
Yep, Reaper Chainsword.
So going back to your 6 attack idea, so potentially you could do 36 damage if you hit and wound on all. Realistically, though, easily get 24 wounds on your first swing is pretty reliable.
Oh, yeah. Especially if you're rerolling all your hits. Hitting on 3s, rerolling, and then wounding almost everything in the game on 2s. Even most knights, right, on 2s. Yeah, you're going to do 24 would be the floor, I think, of what you would expect if he's at full profile.
Yep, especially because he's just punching straight through armor on most things. That EP4 is amazing.
Yep. So, but you have another weapon option, and it's the following. A Synaptic Obliterator, which right off the bat gets points for name. This is a 72-inch weapon. It's only heavy D3, and man, you do have 2 of these. So 2D3 as opposed to 6D3. But this one happens to be strength 16, AP minus 4, and a flat 6 damage as well. But wait, don't call yet. It comes with a transdimensional projector on the same gun. Each one of these is 24 inches, heavy D6, strength 6, AP minus 3, D3 damage. And yes, every time you roll a wound, to wound roll of a 6, you inflict an additional mortal wound.
Yeah, that's a bonkers loadout. Gives you a little bit more versatility, I think, than the generator, even though this thing is going to be moving up the field, so the 36-inch range isn't the end of the world, but it's going to be real hard to hide from that 72-inch gun, considering this thing moves even 8 inches at its lowest profile. So essentially has 80 inches of range, which is table range, even at its lowest profile. So no hiding from that thing. If it can see you, it can shoot you.
Yep.
And then last but not least, let's say you actually kill one of these things. Damage is still not done. If this model is reduced to 0 wounds, roll a d6 when removing them from the battlefield. On a 4 to a 5, each unit within 2d6 suffers d6 mortal wounds. And on a 6, if it explodes and breaches the transdimensional barrier, each unit within 3d6 suffers d6 mortal wounds.
Yeah, you don't want to kill this thing in your lines, even though you don't have a choice. Obviously, ideally, you want to kill it in the Necron lines. Easier said than done with 28 wounds, toughness 8. Yeah, that thing's going to be coming right at you, and when you kill it, you better be far away from it. So,
and that's not easy to do. Even as baby profile, that 8 inches is still faster than most things that can get away from it.
Yep. Yeah, you're not charging this thing. You know, the old charge the castle and kill it in close combat, that works real good. Except for in this thing, even if you kill it, you're gonna eat D6 mortal wounds, most likely. You know, 50% chance you're gonna eat D6 mortal wounds is not ideal for smash captains and their like. So,
and I'm fairly certain that a Necron player will have command points to reroll this. By the way,
yeah, you're more than likely. Yep. It also, real quick, I don't know if you're covering this, Eric. It has a cool rule that gets rid of all the ambiguity with its legs and stuff, because they gave you a little overhead view of pretend it has a base, even if it doesn't have a base, and use all measurements as if it had this base. So you get rid of all the shenanigans of, you know, oh, am I measuring from the hole? Am I measuring from the foot? Am I measuring from this, that? So that's actually nice. They did that on the data sheet so that it's obvious for everybody. The upside of that is, you know, if I'm on the second floor, you can't punch me at least, which is good.
Yeah, I didn't go over that, so thank you for bringing that up. Yeah, it actually shows a nice diagram how to measure the base. I'm still stuck on, why don't you put a base on it? I just don't get it.
Yeah, the answer is because then you can do shenanigans and punch people on the third floor. That's why you wouldn't put a base on it.
I guess. I don't know. I just looked at that one like, why? Why?
Yeah, I agree. Plus, they look cooler on bases, I think, so.
Well, it's interesting if you look at all the new orc vehicles. I mean, they're all on bases. I mean, those are little buggies and whatnot. And so it seems like the idea of a model without a base might be the endangered species.
We can hope. We can hope.
I also think that the reason why it doesn't come with a base is specifically because those legs are movable. Like, when you put them on, I'm sure that they move left and right as far as where you glue them into, because that's how most of those, you know, like spider-like vehicles are built. So I'm sure they just couldn't figure out the right size base to put on that thing. But they say that after you have the model built, this is where basically a rubber banding it is the best way I can describe how this
yep.
hexagon is a giant rubber band around the corners.
Yeah, and they're not movable, so you won't be able to game that in game by making him skinnier to get through his place or fatter. Because that resin, I guess you could do it, but it'd take an awful lot of work to ball joint all those legs where you could adjust them. So I don't think you have to worry too much about that. So
After you build it, he's probably going to stay exactly as he is. But until then, make him as pretty looking as you want with the dynamic poses.
Yep, exactly. Yeah. And he's ready for Kitbash additions to him to make him look even more Necron and more cool, in my opinion, being a Kitbash guy. When I was looking at the kit, I thought, man, there's so many cool things you can do with this guy. So many cool things. So he's a cool model. He's resin, so he'll be a little tough to work with, which makes Kitbashing and green stuff sort of the ideal way to modify your guy if you want to make him look a little bit different, a little cool. Not that you're going to see a bunch of these on the table, because I imagine they're pretty expensive. I didn't look at the price point, but...
They're 310 American.
Okay, so not terrible. Yeah, but still a little pricey, so you're probably not going to see swarms of them out there, but they're a cool model, and easily if you want to run two or three of them, three would be tough, but if you want to run two of them, you could definitely kitbash and make the two look different, which would be easy and fun, in my opinion. So,
yeah, if you were to run three of them, they're 625 points a piece, so that would be 1875. You'd have 125 for maybe like one character.
Yeah, yeah.
I was joking with Don. I'm going to run two of them with my pylon.
There you go. Super heavy detachment. Maybe they'll get the cool knights rule where if you run three of these guys, you get 6 command points.
Yeah, we'll see.
So just going back to the dynasty thing, now that you guys have actually heard about this guy's weapons and whatnot, I think that they're actually going to be the most scary in close combat. They can do a fair bit of shooting, but the close combat is where they're going to be frightening. And the reason why I keep going back to Novak as the way you should run these guys is, like I was saying earlier, you get to reroll all field of hits any turn that you charge, get charged, Shuriken Intervene, with any model that is Novak. And then you'll also be able to use the fight again stratagem. And there's also a Warlord trait that makes it so that every time you roll a 6 to hit in the fight phase, you generate an additional attack. This is just like Mortarion with Death to the False Emperor, where, like, if you use your Reaping Sweeps, you generate an extra attack. And say you're using more of the Reaping Sweeps, the split attacks, basically. Each attack will give you 3 extra hit rolls. So you just explode on anything you want to kill.
Yep, brutal. Fight again. You did the math. What'd you say, Don? 58, average 58 attacks or something?
Yeah,
with the fight again. And then
it's in the mid-50s for how many hit rolls that you get.
Yeah, bonkers. Bonkers.
Absolutely insane. Just when you thought you saw enough of Tesseract Vaults.
Right, yeah, now you're going to see this.
Things are coming next.
Exactly.
Okay. But just when you thought that was all the news from Games Workshop, there was one more announcement. They have a new box game coming out around the Blackstone Fortress. They're talking about it as a tabletop role-playing game, which is all interesting and all in it. But the hot stuff that we're talking about here from a competitive standpoint is there are some new models supposedly locked inside it. They previewed one model today, and that is another Rogue Trader character. Interesting character. I've not seen any particular rules. I did get some firsthand play against the other Rogue Trader from Kill Team, and they're not like over the top, but they're an interesting little twist. So be curious to see what these rules are for the tabletop when it comes to 40K.
I heard one, and definitely apply salt to this, but I heard that one of the models in there might be a new Abaddon.
That is the biggest rumor that's what they're keeping under lock and key within the Black Fortress, is that Abaddon is supposed to come out. Who knows? You know, we'll hear soon enough. This game's supposed to be out in the next couple weeks. And hopefully, Abaddon definitely needs a new model, but curious to see what comes out.
Yeah, the model looks pretty neat. It's a very, it's not steampunk. It's not techy enough to be that, but it's, he's got this cool cloak of some sort of beast. He's got the cod piece. He's rocking the cod piece, which is always a plus. You know, we want to protect that area. as best we can, even with some bolted on leather. So yeah, he looks pretty cool. Monocle, smoking a big old cigar, complete with smoke, which is cool. Or a pipe. I can't tell what it is, not being a smoker myself, but it's a cool looking model. The one they previewed from it.
Yeah. They said pretty cool looking. At the very least, it'd be a great stand-in for a character. So curious what else comes out. So as always, we'll keep you guys up to date via Facebook page. So without further ado, after the break, we will dive into the SoCal Open. Talk to you guys in a couple minutes.
Are you a gamer that has more bare plastic than you have time to paint? Do Fantasy combust when you hold them? If either of these is true, contact White Crow Studios and get your models painted by a college-trained professional painter. You can contact Bo at whitecrow.commissions@gmail.com and view his previously painted models at White Crow Studios on Facebook.
Welcome back after the break. Let's dive into it. SoCal, arguably the last major event here stateside before the LVO. So lots of maneuvering, lots of also the first opportunity to see some of the new army since the large FAQ dropped just about 4 weeks ago. So right off the bat, did it feel any different looking at the armies that were out on the fields?
It didn't look that different for me, except for I didn't get to play that many nights. I played two nights the whole, you know, the whole six rounds instead of what I was expecting four. But I didn't see anything too crazy. The FAQ, mostly it looked like people were just ignoring it and trying to play their same armies to me, like the games that I got to see when I finished my games early. Some of the intricacies, I think, of the FAQ still haven't sunk all the way in. That was my impression.
And I will definitely echo that. The list did not seem all that different. The Castellan lists were still there, but the big part that was different with that was I didn't see as many Blood Angel captains with those, because all the CP was going straight to the Castellan instead of being split up. But other than that, still saw Yanari for days, Dark Elder for days. And California tends to have a large amount of Chaos players. I played quite a few of them too. So it didn't really look like the FAQ changed what people brought, really, aside from the Blood Angels with the Castellan.
Yep.
Ray, looking from the outside in, I know you and I were kind of messaging back and forth all weekend. Did you see anything different from the outside perspective?
I saw a few lists that I would have never expected, but I wouldn't say anything too crazy.
I think what I saw was a lot of reshuffling I would say a fair amount of reshuffling, where it was the same list we saw prior to the FAQ, but instead of having a battalion and something else, they decided to take a battalion and something else and mush it together to get a brigade, because they didn't have as much CP regeneration before. I don't think I ever saw a brigade in competitive play more than once, and I saw several armies with brigades all of a sudden.
Yeah, I think if you look at Brandon Grant's list, that list was sort of the optimized version. If you were trying to be as close to the pre-FAQ Castellan list as you could, that list was pretty close to the optimized version, I would say.
Yep. Yeah, we'll have to see how he did as we get into more of our discussion. The other thing I thought was interesting was the guys over at Frontline Gaming posted several pictures of the tables, so you had an idea what the terrain would look like. And Don and I was peppering Don with 1,001 questions. So how did the terrain work out, and how did you guys work out the rules of all those square buildings?
I've been trying to be really good about following the packet. So I'm trying to discuss terrain with every opponent before the game starts. You had some interesting interpretations from guys. And in some cases, sometimes better just to kind of let it go. But I found that if you just talk about it ahead of time, you know, it's probably the best way to do it. Because some of them were odd. Some of them had doors and windows and gaps. And, you know, the ITC packet says, you know, there's no gaps there. But does that just apply for line of sight? Or can you actually charge through it if you're a bike? Those are the conversations I had with a couple of different people.
Yeah. And, yeah, like as far as like the stuff that you couldn't really see into, it was some of those things where we discussed it with each opponent. By and large, most of my opponents were like, if you can't actually, like, take the top off and put your models inside, you can't get in there. But it's whatever you guys really, you know, decided on amongst each other. But it seemed to be pretty common, was just basically if you have too much of a hard time getting your models in there, just don't even worry about it. I actually had an opponent that wound up putting his Nurglings inside of a enclosed building, And the first thing with the FAQ that happened was his Nurglings couldn't get out.
Right, because they didn't give swarms the ability to get out of it, of ruins. Yeah.
So he was stuck in there the entire game. It's just one of those funny things. Didn't really change the game at all, but it was like, oh, wait.
Yeah, I actually had a similar experience, but I just went, that's stupid, and I let the guy move his Nurglings out because, to me, it was dumb. So I had a similar experience when I played a Death Guard player, and I just was like, absolutely retarded that you can't move your guys out. Go ahead and do that. So,
yeah.
And I had to admit that the terrain looked great, you know, photographic wise, but I kept looking at it like, okay, how's that going to work? How's that going to play? Do you guys feel it still had enough line of sight blocking for the addition, or could it still use a little more pieces here and there?
I actually thought it was fine. It's funny because Don said most of his guy, you know, discussions ended with like impassable terrain. Most of mine just said treat it as ruins. Just put your guys on top. Make sure everybody knows they're on the first floor. So I actually had kind of a different experience, and generally that stuff doesn't matter to me too much. So I just let my opponent, however my opponent wants to play it, you know, makes the most sense to me. Just cause you know, those aren't arguments that are worth having, especially starting a game. You don't want to get off on a bad tone. So I actually was fine. You know, I didn't think that, there was some really odd, totally open buildings, and I did have, so I had a lopsided table at one point. Fortunately my opponent was really cool and it was like, hey, can we just play this as an enclosed building or else I have no line of sight blocking on my side. And he agreed to that. So.
Interesting. Yep. Okay.
And yeah, I played it across several tables that there were some that were very, very line of sight heavy. And there were some that were, not Planet Bowling Ball, but basically if you had decent sized models, you were not hiding them.
Interesting. Okay. The other thing, I don't know if you guys were keen on this, but sometimes when you have large events, other people take this as an opportunity to get on a stage and kind of promote their cause, for lack of a better term. And fellow podcaster Val Heffelfinger decided that to take to the internet and talk about we need to standardize list format. And I guess Aris had said that they're going to follow the ETC format. And he said, as a ETC player, he felt that was the worst choice ever. And it was very interesting that several other key tournament players and organizers echoed that same sentiment. Did you guys get any of that feel at the tournament that maybe list format still wasn't really under control?
There was definitely some of that because some people's lists, like if you're not using BCP or your handwriting lists, people taking pictures of lists and uploading it as a PDF, you couldn't read. I had an opponent, fortunately, a really nice guy, and he had printed copies, but his posted list was like a handwritten that I couldn't read because it was very blurry. I agree with standardized list formats because I just think it makes it better for everybody. Plus, then if you make an honest mistake with your list, hopefully they catch it ahead of time. You don't end up getting DQ'd. I'd hate to have a list. Oh man, you know you didn't play for the plasma gun, or you had a melta gun, or whatever that you didn't pay for, or that you paid for, but you had the wrong value on. Oh, you're 3 points over, and you're out of the tournament. So I'm actually for it. I don't know anything about the ETC format, so I couldn't tell you if it's good versus some other option that's out there that would be better.
Yeah, and I know that they did not enforce any kind of actual formatting for this event, and it's still in discussion as towards how they want to do it. It's just, I know that the thing they're leaning towards is just ETC because that's the standardized thing for outside the IGC, it seems like. So I think he's just trying to make it as uniform as possible between that, but we'll see where it goes.
Yeah, what I heard Reese say about it was he did not want to force people to buy a third-party product to submit their lists. So I think that's where the ETC format, I guess, makes sense, is because it doesn't cost you anything. You don't have to buy a program or whatever to do it. So he did. I did hear him say that when we were talking about some of these things.
So I listened to the Signals from the Frontline from last Friday, and the way it was described is basically just having everybody type it up on a word processor, so like Word or Google Docs. So it'd be something anybody could do. They wouldn't need to buy any kind of a program. But there would be an emphasis on trying to make sure everybody spelled things right because they'd want to use it, that information to kind of gauge how often certain war gear or relics get used.
It's a data mining thing.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah.
Which would be awesome too, because it'd be for an analytics person like myself, that would be really fun to look at these tournaments I don't get to go to, and even tournaments you do go to, you don't get to. You know, you're very concentrating on what you're doing. You don't, you know, unless you get a buy or you have an opponent that doesn't show up or something, you're not going to be able to take in all this information. You know, so it'd be neat to see. I think.
I definitely like the idea that, yeah, being able to disseminate the information. There's some, I guess, I can't remember. It wasn't Renegade Open, but one of the other large Midwest tournaments. I apologize, guys, because we did report on it. They used a standardized format, so BCP was able to pull the information
Iron Halo.
Quickly. Thank you, Iron Halo. And that was really telling, because there's a lot of information that kind of surprised me, actually, what they were seeing in that particular tournament. I agree with you don't want to, you know, shoehorn people into using one particular app, but as a guy who runs several tournaments and I go, sometimes those handwritten lists are kind of creative. I love the combat squatting cultist squads. That was my favorite so far. He just wrote down on his list, I have 60 cultists. I don't know if that was 3 units of 20. I don't know if that was 1 unit of 30 and 2 units of, you know, whatever. And sure enough, I caught the player. He was mixing it up each round to his needs. I was like, nice right. try.
Yeah, not how it works.
Yep. So that's not how it works.
Fortunately, I didn't have any problems with stuff like that. It was, every list I came across was fairly easy to read in the different formats they had it in. But like, you had Excel spreadsheets, you had Battlescribe printouts with out all the excess junk on it, or, you know, people just flat out typed it like I do. But I never had any issues figuring out what my opponent actually had as far as what they showed me or what was on the BCP that they uploaded.
My biggest thing is just want to standardize, this is what you're supposed to tell your opponent. Because one of the things when I was playing in, like, back in fifth edition, most people had Army Builder. So not only did you get somebody's army list, but you also, if you didn't know the army that well, or that particular codex, it usually had the stats on there. So I'm like, okay, which one's that again? Oh, cool. It's toughness 4. All right, I'll shoot that at this. And then now we've come to an age where, yeah, you're kind of typing it on a word processor type program. It won't have the stat lines at all. So you need to have the codices handy to look up what is the stat line on this. I mean, yes, you can ask your opponent, but, you know, by the 23rd question, I think you're going to annoy the crap out of them. So
yeah, that can't happen. I have a little cheat sheet for myself that I just put the stat lines of all my units on it. But that I don't actually, now that you mentioned that, I don't think I've ever shown that to an opponent to help them. I guess I should offer that up, but I never have.
I only did it once. I had a guy similar to the experience you talked about, Daniel, one time, where the guy was basically abusing the clock by asking me 1,001 questions during my turn. And I'm definitely a process guy. Like, I know what I need to get done. I need to get from point A to point B. And every time you interrupt, I have to start over. I get annoyed. So I finally just hand it to him. Says, it's all right there. Look it up. Yep. Which probably cost me a sportsmanship point, but whatever. But you're right. I have the list I give out to my opponents, the list I forget to upload to BCP, and then I've got my clipboard, which is my cheat sheet, and it looks like something like an offensive coordinator would use on the sidelines of an NFL game. You know, it's double-sided, it's floppy, it's laminated. I'm holding it up to my face so they can't read my lips. The whole nine yards.
As you spell out your next move.
Exactly. You know, yeah, Omaha, 431, yeah, yeah. 6 on 2. Awesome.
That's a good play. I'm going to start doing that. Just to mess with people.
Yeah. It's just a lousy screen pass, but who cares?
Yeah. Yep.
All right. Speaking of a lousy screen pass, let's get into the thick of it. So let's talk about your guys, game one.
I played a Tau player, him and his brother, first tournament they've ever played in. You know, coming from a small, I think he said Reading. Really nice guy. He unfortunately is playing Tau Gunline against, you know, Eldar that do that better, plus can hold objectives. So it was a bit of a teaching game, but had a lot of fun. He actually came up to me throughout the tournament to check on how I was doing. We had several conversations. He'd say, oh, hey, I just played this guy. He had this list. What do you think? I gave him some thoughts on it. Cause you know, we have a guy locally that plays Tau. So I play him quite a bit. So I was able to say, well, this is how our guy plays. And this is what I've seen him be successful with. And this is what I've seen him not be successful with. So I actually had a blast turn one. It was a bit of a blowout, but it was a really fun game.
It's cool that you get to share that too, because that's part of the fun of if you're not going to win it, you can at least learn and be ready for the next tournament. So that's pretty awesome.
yeah, we want those guys to come back. You need that guy at the next tournament. So you gotta win because we're there to win. But you know, you can do that and be it's not about being nice, it's just about being informative and letting them learn and kind of reading how they're reacting to stuff and helping them out where you can. You know, I have a problem, and you guys know this, I'll coach against myself if you ask me. I try not to do that at majors. I still sometimes do it. But it's still, there's some sportsmanship there. And then there's also just, we need players to keep coming to these tournaments. So you're better off treating them with respect. So,
yep. So my first opponent was Craft World, Dark Eldar, and you know, Dark Reaper Tower, player, also his first tournament. So that was a bit of a learning game because I'm running the thing that if you just go line up shooting across the board from each other, it should win more often than not. It's just a whole bunch of durable units that shoot a lot of shots. But yeah, like Daniel was saying, just try to be as informative as possible. And it seemed like we had a good time, but yeah, it was a bit one-sided.
Yeah, looking at his list, I saw that in your first matchup there, and I was like, yeah, you see a lot of that in our local area, so Don definitely knows how this is scripted and how it needs to take place. No other major games to really talk about in round one. Everything went pretty much according to script. Some of the top players really did well. I think what's more interesting when we really got to see who was actually there is a couple of players we haven't heard from in quite some time making an appearance. So Thomas Hextrom Oakley, who is your defending Deptis Astartes champion from 2017-2018 season, was there, and he opened the SoCal with a tie. And Kenny Boucher, mostly known for his painting exploits in his video there, also, surprise, surprise, brought a Chaos Army and actually won his first game. So it's nice to see some of the old names back in the mix of things. Moving on to round two, starts to heat up a little bit. Tell us a little about your round two games.
So I got Mark. I got Mark from here, from Phoenix. Blood Angels, you know, night list. We've played that game a whole bunch of times. That's a tough matchup for Mark. He played a brilliant game. Actually negated one of my secondaries by simply hiding his knight because it was the right play. I've never seen anybody do that. It didn't get to shoot much, but it also didn't give up secondary points until the end of the game when I didn't have anything left that could hurt it. Real tight game. I think it was a 7-point game or something. I managed to pull it out, but it was a fun game. It was a close game. It's a bummer that stuff has to happen. Round two, you know, you play somebody from Phoenix, but sometimes that happens.
And then I got to play Kevin, who he's one of the guys from in the War Room Games guys up at Las Vegas, and he's running a Gilliman character brick with a couple of Eyes and Dreadnoughts, and he found out very fast what Death Guard Hellforge Dreadnoughts do when you surround them with a whole bunch of characters and kill them. Death Guard had a wonderful little stratagem where it's, I think it's called Putrid Detonation, where instead of rolling to see if it explodes, it does. And all the Hellforge Dreadnoughts, or, you know, Hellforge vehicles in general, have a wonderful rule that they normally do more mortal wounds to Psykers. And he had, you know, I think he had three Space Marine Psykers and just D6 damage on each thing there. But I had so many things that were into all those guys that could do all that damage that it was just explosion, explosion, explosion. And even the Clexus Assassins hitting on sixes, I don't care. You're taking D3 mortal wounds every time that you kill something. And I was able to pull that one out.
Some of the notables from round two, he stepped in as a guest host a couple weeks ago, but good old Ben Jurek playing Codex Orcs, trying to give him one last hurrah before the Codex comes out. He won his opening round game, but ran into Steve Pamprin of the ITC team, and looks like it was a tight game, but was unable to pull that one out, so suffered an early loss there on the day. Oh, our local favorite, Henry, you mentioned, Daniel, that you play a lot against a lot of Tau players. So Henry's one of our more prominent Tau players here locally. Actually was able to defeat Thomas Hegstrom Oakley in round two. So good props to you, Henry. Appreciate showing the make us look good here for our Arizona team. But that's pretty much, and for those of you who are listening from the 11th Company podcast, former co-host of mine, Alan Hernandez, at this point goes 2-0, and he actually knocked off Herb Schaefer. I was like, oh my gosh. So Herb, one of the top five Dark Eldar players currently on the ITC circuit. So that was quite a close match as well. So really set up round three for some really exciting matchups. So let's go into that. How'd you guys do round three?
I played Steve Pamperine, who had just pitted Ben. He was running 7 Wave Serpents, 30 Guardians, 15 Dire Avengers, Eldrad, 2 Spirit Seers Warlock, and then a Break of Shining Spears. Real close game, 1-point game. He edged me out. It was the beginning of the drama that would then unfold the next day. You know, he was doing the whole, I guess that's a meta list. I guess it's a list he said he doesn't normally play Eldar. I guess he's a Nurgle player, he was saying, but it wasn't competitive enough. But I guess it had done well in some majors, so that's what he brought out.
We've talked about this list a couple times on previous episodes, and probably the most annoying thing about this list is, what the heck do you shoot at turn one?
Yeah, and with prepared positions, you know, he actually forced me to go first, I believe, and then drop prepared positions, so all his Wave Serpents 2-up armor. You know, I have the tools to deal with it. It wasn't a list I was afraid of. Had I played a better game, a smarter game, I think I could have pulled that game out. It was really tight. That game showed me a lot of things, you know, from the meta to hey, you know, I haven't played this type of player before, to a list that I hadn't played before. Wasn't unbeatable, but again, your target priority has to sort of be spot on. And it's so puzzle piece, right? Like if you do some damage on one side, they're so fast, even at their lowest tier, that he just switches positions. And now you've got one that's hidden. And we played on a table that had a big centerpiece line of sight blocking terrain. So he was able to just swap them out. So if you knock, you know, if I killed one and knocked another one down to 2 or 3, he just swapped positions, put a full one in the lane, hide the one that was damaged behind the building, you know, discharge if he had something to discharge at. And then, you know, use it as to get, if you did whittle a squad down to a couple guys, they'd get back in the damaged one that you couldn't see. So it's a smart list. It's a fun list to play against as a KG player. I can see how it would be very frustrating if you don't understand what Wave Serpents do or can do. So,
Don, how did your round three go?
So I got to play against Jeff Poole, who is an awesome guy to play against. If you haven't played against him before, great opponent, extremely smart. He's the guy that last time he beat me, taught me the importance of when your opponent picks old school, don't go first and hide your stuff. I did not learn from that when I tried to play him again. Granted, this time he went from Craft Worlds last time to playing Chaos this time. But he didn't give me anything really to shoot at turn one. And the worst part was I screwed up by picking to go first. And that also compounded the issue in my turn three. I had everything nice and set up to zone out all of his deep striking stuff. And then I broke my deep strike zone on my turn three, which was the top. And then he was able to come down with 45 Bloodletters and another 25 Zangors and kept me locked in for the rest of the game. So I just couldn't score any points at all at that point. So he won out by quite a fair bit. It was, I think, 35-15. I just couldn't score anything.
Fair enough. So as we conclude day one of SoCal, this is your top 8 going into day two. So in 8th place, Brandon Grant. 7th place, the aforementioned Jeff Poole. 6th place, Matt Johansson. 5th place, the aforementioned Stephen Pamperine. 4th place, Adam Gotti. 3rd place, Raymond Amuda. 2nd place, Kenny Boucher with a brilliantly painted army. And then 1st place going into day one was Nick Rose. So how does it all play out? We'll cover day two right after the break. Welcome back after the break. Now breaking down day two of the SoCal Open. I'm here still with Don and Daniel. Ray's also here in the wings. Daniel, tell us a little about your game four.
So game four, I got to play Ben, Orc player from Vegas. I think I've played him. He's come down to the last two GTs we had, and I played him, I think, for the first place in both those GTs. And I didn't play him last time I was in Vegas, but I'll probably get to play him this time, this coming weekend when I go up there. that list that he's running has a tough time against Eldar Castle. Having been 2-1, and I think he was 2-1 at that point also, we actually decided to brawl a little bit. I came out real aggressive, and I told him, hey, well, let's just have a fun game. Let's see what happens. Dice went my way. Rolls went my way. He failed to jump his Mega Knobs with a reroll on his turn two, which would have been much worse for me. So I was able to pull out a pretty big win, but we had a really fun game. I did not play smart. If anybody walked by that game, I went, why is Daniel rushing his Dark Reapers at orcs? I did it for fun and I just got the win. Maybe it was a little karmic justice, I guess, for me for wanting to have a fun game instead of just sitting back and walking away from him shooting. But it was a good game. Ben's an awesome opponent, super knowledgeable. I'm terrified of what his orcs are going to do to my army after they get their codex.
You and me both. The other orc player, by the way, Rich Kilton at this point, he was also 2-1 and tied his game 4 against Julio Orege. Julio, if I mispronounced your last name, I'm so sorry.
He was 2-0-1 is the better way to put it. He was not, he did not have a loss
yet. Okay, thank you. Don, how'd your game 4 go?
All right, so my game 4, I played against another person that this one I actually have not played against before, but you hear about him all the time. He's a great person, everything like that. Ryan Mead, who is running Mortarian with the Renegade version of the Castellan and a couple Armagers with a whole bunch of little Death Guard stuff and Plague Drones. So it was a fun little, like, Nurgle on Nurgle fight for the most part, aside from, you know, the Knights. But
three models died total. Was...
Something like that. But yeah, it was a great game. We were joking around the entire time. Ultimately, I picked the wrong secondaries and it just didn't go my way. But at the end of the game, there were literally 4 miles left on the table between both of us. And those are, in my opinion, the best games.
Great matchups. Actually surprised yeah, that there are many that little left, given everybody's got disgusting resilience. But that's pretty cool. Quick roundup of your other top games during round 4. Nick Rose was able to dispatch Kenny Bruchet and end his winning streak. Adam Gotti also was able to defeat Raymond Amuda. Matt Johansson was able to take out Stephen Pampreem. And last but not least, Brandon Grant took out Jeff Poole in round 4, setting up for an interesting round 5. This also opened the door for a couple of players we haven't heard from quite some time, kind of leaping into the thick of it. And that would be Alan Hernandez, who at this point is now 4-0. And sort of a local guy, he's recently moved to our area, Matt Baugh, kind of sneaking up into the top 8 at this point. So curious to see what happens in round 5. Guys, Danny, what happened in your round 5?
So I played Julio, the guy you mentioned earlier. I'm not going to even attempt his last name because I will butcher it. Great guy, awesome guy. Was a guy who played a lot of competitive 4th and 5th edition. This was his first, him and his buddy came down from LA to San Diego to play in this tournament, their first kind of 8th edition tournament experience. It was his misfortune, unfortunately, to be running a list very similar to the list Don took to Bay Area, a list I've played against a bunch of times. And so I was able to sort of, I knew what to do. And we talked about it afterwards. He had played a couple of games previous where he was being very defensive and that had worked for him. He tried to be very defensive against me and sort of laying me out. Obviously, with Fire and Fate, I can do that better than him. And so I sort of picked him apart until I could, you know, bounce on his castle and beat him. But we had a great conversation afterwards. There's another guy who I, you know, exchanged phone numbers with and is talking about coming out to our Phoenix event. So might get an LA guy coming out to our Phoenix event. It's him and his buddy, which would be really cool. So
more than welcome. And by the way, that's March 2nd and 3rd in Glendale, Arizona. Don, how'd your team vibe go?
All right, so by this time I was 2-2, so I knew I wasn't going to be in a position to get into top 8 or anything like that. So I decided that I was going to play all my games just to make sure my opponents had a good time. This one I played against competitive Grey Knights for the first time with Shaylin, and she had Grey Knights, Sisters of Battle, and Smash Captains with all sorts of command points to spend all in the first 2 turns. So I just went like, okay, I'm just going to sit up on the line. We're going to play a fun little game. And I proceeded to only kill anything of hers with explosions because I could not damage anything in our army outside of explosions. And Grey Knights really, really do not like that reactor that does D6 mortal wounds to Psykers.
I can't imagine why.
And of course, everything was Combat Squad bunched up, so just threw all those reactors right into those. She'd get a couple wounds through, make it die, and then I'd be like, one command point, and it explodes. And it just did work that way. But yeah, another game where I couldn't kill anything, but she had fun, I had fun, it's all good.
So other key matchups that particular round, Brandon Grant is able to take out Nick Rose on the top table. Matt Johansson, continuing his winning streak, takes out Aaron Wish. Name that you probably know from 40K and Frontline Gaming Legendary, but mostly known for the pub crawl at the Las Vegas Open. But guess what? This guy can play. Cooper Waddell knocks off Adam Gotti and starts to make a rude entrance into the top eight. Alan Hernandez knocks off one of our local guys, Chase Enquist, who at that point was on quite a run as well. And last but not least, Rich Kelton, who we mentioned earlier, was able to knock off Raymond Almuda and pretty much put an end to his run this weekend. But as we talked about, Matt Ball was kind of lurking in the shadows there and making a run for the top of the leaderboard, was able to knock off Kenny Boucher. So that's two in a row that Kenny's lost on day two after a brilliant day one. Which leads us now to the final round, round six. By the way, what time did they actually start round six? It seemed really late.
Yeah, it was a little late.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I think the top table actually ran late round six, so they kind of extended the round. My game, obviously, if anybody knows, was done pretty fast, so I was walking around for that point, but it felt like a long time for sure. I know the awards were late, but I think that was because the top table game that was on stream ran a little slow, or a lot slow.
Yeah. Let me do mine first, since yours is the interesting one. So I got to play against someone that's actually local to Phoenix that I had not ever played before. He's just getting back into the game, everything like that. Like I said, at that point, I was making sure everyone had fun. I was 2-3 at that point, so I was playing a little bit low. But yeah, this guy, he just finished painting up his models after being gone since Rogue Trader days, and just came on, apparently heard about me, things like that, and it turned into basically a teaching game, which unfortunately my dice were much hotter than his were, so that game wrapped up fairly quickly. But it's good. I was able to get him to want to start coming out to our events. And it seemed like he had a good time, even though the dice were not in his favor at all for that game. Like his rapid fire battle cannon, thermal cannons, they shot two or one shot a piece and normally missed. It was one of those kind of games.
We've all had them, and it's just a matter of just working your way through it. So,
yep, the dice give, the dice take away.
So yeah, this was sort of a under the radar kind of, this game kind of broke out after the tournament. So one reason I wanted to have you on, Daniel, full disclosure, yeah, we're friends prior to this incident. So I'm not here to take sides, but I want to at least give you an opportunity to give us your side of the story of what happened. There's another side of the story available on other internet news sites related to 40K. And if you can add the two together, I'm sure our listeners can make their own opinions moving forward.
Sure, sure. And I'm not here to rehash anything or to get crazy or call anybody out. You know, we talked about that. So my game six was against Nick Rose, who is buddies with Steam Pampreen, who was the guy who played round three, day one. And there was not friction, but certainly there were some scoring irregularities. And I had talked to Steve in the morning of Sunday and just said, hey, I'm not going to the judges, but I just want to talk to you about this. And he said, you know, you're right, but I think that there was points that you missed for me because he wasn't scoring his own sheet. So we're just going to call it a win. And I said, okay, that's fine. And Nick was there, and he didn't think it was fair of me to talk to Steve about that the next day, which is fine. It's within his prerogative. So when I drew him round six, I was pretty happy because he's a great player. He's top 10. Those are the guys I want to play. So we go over. When he got to the table, you know, we started setting up, just kind of went over everything. We defined terrain. We actually removed some tops because one person had removed a top of a building before us, apparently. We didn't realize that it was lopsided, that it was actually supposed to be on a middle terrain. So we actually removed them, and they ended up getting put back on later because he felt it would give him a little bit better line of sight blocking. So that was a little interesting that they came off the table and they went back on. At that point, when we discussed terrain and everything, I said, hey, you know, let's just play this game straight. I'm not going to ask for any leeway. I'm not going to give any leeway because of what, it, you know, kind of my experience that happened the day before. So we get into the game. I go first. I kill. He doesn't kill anything first turn. I kill some stuff. Second turn is kind of more of the same. He gets two kills because his rock truck exploded and did 6 wounds to a Venom and 5 wounds to an Archon. I managed 1 Feel No Pain between the 11. So I lost a Venom and then my Archon down to 1 wound. It was, my opinion, pretty lopsided at that point. All his vehicles were dead. All he had to do damage against me was Aberrants left. My Reaper Castle's untouched and completely safe. So it's bottom of 2. He charges. He comes in with a Colt Ambush. So he's 9 inches away, but he rolls a, I believe, a 4 for his, you know, he rolled a 5 for his ambush rules, which allows him to move D6 forward. He rolls a 4. So he's 5 inches away from a Ranger and he's about 11 inches away from my Autarch on jet bike. I kind of set a little trap over there, and I intercepted him, but of course I rolled terribly. So I think I managed to put 1 wound on an Aberrant. And I think I'm going to get these names wrong, but Aberrant is the normal guy. And then the character is an Abominant that comes up with them. Is that right? Okay, so Aberrant's with an Abominant. So he moves around, you know, he does his thing, smites some stuff off, a Ranger squad, 2 Ranger squads, I think, and come into charge phase. He does some charges, including that charge. He declares the Autarch and the Ranger. So he kind of comes in at a diagonal line because he has to, you know, obviously stay in, unit cohesion. But he doesn't charge the Abominant, the character. We move on to the fight phase. He piles in. Declares his attacks against my Autarch, declares his attacks against the Ranger. I lightning fast reactions, and then he goes, oh, I forgot to charge my Abominant. And I go, we're past that, dude. We're in the fight phase. And he goes, well, you know, I haven't done anything yet. And I went, well, you piled in, which makes the charge easier because he just rolls the dice and moves his guy. And I go, no, you know, that's not cool. For a lot of reasons, but that I didn't want to get into because I just feel like it's a simple rules violation and we'll just do it that way. Because we can't move the guys back that he piled in and then try to figure out what the charge would have been because we don't know exactly where those guys were before he piled in. So he says, well, if you're going to do that, I'm going to quit. And I go, okay, well, I told you we were going to play this game by the book. Do what you got to do. He says he's going to go to a judge, goes and gets a judge. You know, Frankie comes over. Frankie goes, well, you know, if you want to be a good sport and let him, you can, but you don't have to. And I just said, no. I said, my previous experiences have taught me not to let people break the rules. I told you I wasn't going to ask for any leeway. I told you I wasn't going to give any leeway. That's when he freaks out again. I'm going to quit. You want to win this way? I'm going to quit. I go, okay, bud. And that's when things started escalating in volume. When the F-bomb started coming out, when he started saying F you, F you, F you, I actually backed up from the table. Fortunately, we were on an end row, so there was no table behind me. So I was about 5 feet from the table when he started going, you're an asshole, F you, you're an asshole, you're a bully, F you. At that point, I did say, hey, if you're going to talk that crap, I didn't say crap, so I did cuss. If you're going to talk that crap, come over here and talk that crap. He chose to interpret that as an excuse to say F you a bunch more times. So I ended up actually backing all the way up to the wall, leaned up against the wall. I was about 18 feet from him, and he just kept screaming. So I gave him the talk, talk, talk gesture with my hand. So I'm certainly not innocent in this escalation. But I can clearly say I did never threaten that guy. I never went over the table at him. I never said anything about hitting the guy. I'm not stupid. B, I cannot fathom a situation where with Frankie and Pablo standing right there, if I tried to attack someone, that they would be okay with that. So if you want to believe that, nothing I can do about it. But I never said F you. I never called him an a-hole. The only thing I did was say, if he wants to talk that crap, he can come talk that crap to my face. And I did give him the talk, talk, talk gesture with my hand. Again, not claiming innocence, but the reports I heard afterwards were comical, in my opinion. And if you choose to believe them, you're making some stretches. But again, if this is a political issue of me versus them, you know, I understand that you got to have your guys back. And I also understand that my people have my back. Obviously, you know, we're a pretty tight crew here. And I didn't feel like there was any imminent physical altercation at any point, honestly. I hope that it's over. I also hope that people understand that, you know, I wish that I could give the leeway. It unfortunately cost me a game early in the tournament doing that. I learned my lesson. I'm not going to give away a game because someone wants leeway when I'm not sure they're going to give it back to me. And unfortunately, I used to err on the side of, oh, yeah, I'll be cool. And then I know this person will be cool back. And it's bitten me a few times. It never bit me as bad as it did on Saturday. And it just taught me a lesson. And so I'm just real clear with my opponents when we're playing for something. At that point, I'm still trying to play to be in the top eight, which is important to me. And so, you know, you just be clear with your opponent. Hey, I'm not going to ask you for leeway. I'm not going to give any leeway. We're going to play by the rules. And I think that's the best way to do it because it just takes all that guessing about motives out of the equation. So.
Well, an unfortunate end, but I think the best that can be handled under the situation. So thank you for sharing. I appreciate you coming on to talk about it.
And, no problem at all.
And likewise, we are open to you interpretation, but as I mentioned, to keep our individual biases out of it, I'm going to leave it there. And as you, the listener, can make your determination from there. So go on, moving on with the rest of the results. So the as I mentioned, round six, there's quite a few key matchups still left to be played out. So moving through the key areas to kind of give things away a little bit, but our good friend Matt Baugh actually did win his last game. And would that be enough for him to leap into the top eight? How about you know, Cooper Waddell versus Alan Hernandez? Two unexpected players meeting at table two, long track record. How would they all pan out? Well, let's go over your top eight as they finalize for SoCal. Okay, that was the longest build-up ever. As I build up time to open up the app. So here we go. Tied for seventh place, Adam Gotti and Matt Johansson. That's right, Matt Johansson ended up losing his last game of the tournament, running into a tie at 5,182 points. So yeah, it's pretty amazing that you can win five games and still not finish in the top eight. Sixth place, Richard Cozart was able to sneak into the top five, also going 5-1. Fifth place, Shane Watts with Adeptus Custodes, making it into fifth place. Daniel, you end up finishing fourth place. Third place, Alex Aquila with Cabal of the Black Heart. A lot of people are talking about his list, and we'll go over that briefly. Second place, the aforementioned Cooper Waddell finishes a perfect 6-0, but it wasn't perfect enough. As your 2018 champion is none other than Brandon Grant with his Astra Militarum and, as we previously mentioned, fully optimized list.
So, and I do believe that is year two for Brandon Grant winning as well.
You know, I hadn't a chance to look that up, so I do apologize if that's the case, but either way.
Granted, I think last time was his opponent got DQ'd for a list issue, but nothing to take away from him. Brandon Gratz, an awesome player and everything like that.
Oh, yeah, amazing guy. Super nice guy, too.
And it's amazing this time of year is also when he got hot. You know, he ended up winning like two or three tournaments. And so being that he hadn't done that yet, we're beginning to wonder, had he fallen on hard times or just couldn't recreate the magic? Well, I think he's catching fire right at the right time of the season.
Yeah.
With LVL.
For sure. And he exercised some demons against Eldar because, you know, I played him at Broadside. That's who I played for first place at Broadside. And we developed a friendship since then and played at Barrier on stream, another really close game. And we actually talked a little bit before the last round and, you know, he bounced some strategy off me and he was 100% right. I didn't have anything to add to his strategy, so I'm not taking any credit at all. You know, he said, this is what I think I should do. And I said, I think that's brilliant. And apparently it worked. I haven't had a chance to watch the game yet, but you know, the little clips and stuff that I saw, it looked like his plan worked to a T. And a nicer guy you can't ask for, and a great opponent. Honestly, the games I've had with him, although close and nerve wracking and probably not good for my heart, were very fun games. So
awesome. Quick review of his list for those of you listening at home. He starts out with a brigade of Katachin jungle fighters. He's got a company commander, Strachan, a Primaris Psyker, 8 infantry squads, a squad of 9 Bulgrin, 5 slab shields and 4 brute shields. Platoon commander, a priest, 1 heavy weapon team of 3 mortars, 2 basilisks, and 3 Artemides hellhounds. And then he adds a super heavy auxiliary detachment of a Castellan Knigget to add that to there.
Yep, runs it as Raven.
Thank you. I couldn't read that. He had it handwritten. Looks like he updated it later.
Yep.
We mentioned Cooper Waddell also going undefeated. He was actually running Tyranids with High Fleet Kraken. Starts off with a battalion with a Swarm Lord and a Hive Tyrant and a Malathrope. He's got 2 units of 10 Harmagaunts, 1 unit of 15 Gene Stealers, a 6-man Hive Guard unit, and a 3-man Tyranid Guard unit. He then adds a Gene Stealer Cult Supreme Command attachment, featuring 2 Magi and a Primus, as well as 15 Pure Strain Gene Stealers. He then rounds out the list with a High Fleet Kronos Battalion featuring 2 Neurothropes and 3 units of 3 Ripper Swarms.
Yeah, that was an interesting list. I wish I had got to see one of his games or play something like that. It looks simple, but he played it so well, maybe. Again, I didn't get to watch any games, but because he beat some really good players with that list.
We've seen this or variations of this list a lot throughout, but it never seems to do this well. It always, it's top 8, but never top 3.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So I think that's something that goes back to.
Sorry.
Go ahead, Ray.
I'm going to say I really like the format for this list and the way it's printed out.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that because I looked at that and goes, it's a simple spreadsheet with, you know, he did color code the battalion, so that goes a little extra mile, but it's pretty easy to read. So, pardon me, if you're looking for a standardized list format, I would look at this.
Yeah, and I almost wonder too, with the color coding, was that maybe what he did his bases in so that it was super obvious? Because that would be genius, actually.
Actually, he says something to that effect.
Did he? Okay, we'll see. He had a really good idea just before me. That means, you know, we're really smart together.
There we go. I saw it on a couple other people's armies list that they actually wrote on their army list, this is the base color or this is the how I've added. I have great intentions. I just never finished painting my models. So I'm like, the gray ones are these and the gray ones are those. It's quite clear to me on what your problem is.
Right. Sure.
And then this list is getting a lot of traction online. To be honest with you, I don't know. I'm just a bitter player from afar. So maybe this is what's wrong with it. But Alex Aquila came in 3rd place with Dark Eldar, and everybody was surprised. Oh my God, he probably played pure Dark Eldar. So he ends up running a brigade.
Well, it wasn't pure. Yeah, it wasn't pure.
Yeah, it wasn't pure. But anyway, he runs a brigade of Cabal the Blackheart featuring 3 Archons, all with blasters and husk blades. 6 units of Cabalite Warriors, 5-man squads, all with blasters. 3 units of Mandrakes, 3 units of Scourges, 2 of them filled out with 4 Haywire Blasters, and 1 of them with blasters, regular blasters. Heavy weapons, he's got 3 Ravagers, all with Disintegrator Cannons. And then for dedicated transports, he's got 2 Raiders and 3 Venoms. And then in the aforementioned, he's got an auxiliary support detachment of a lone Farseer Skyrunner to leech off a little bit of Doom and Executioner.
The all-powerful Doom combination with that Haywire blasters is how he's dealing with. I'm sure is how he's dealing with knights. So
really interesting. Glad to see what we had here. So overall, a great event. As with some of the other people we talked about during the show, Matt Baugh just missing the top 8, ended up coming in 9th, missing that logjam tie for 7th by 1 point. So hat goes off to you, buddy. Other local favorite, Derek Page with Imperial Knights, also coming in 14th place. Alan Hernandez ending 15th place, ended up losing his last game. Friend of the show, Aurelio Carrero, coming in 16th place. The aforementioned Ryan Mead ended up finishing 19th place. Rich Kilton with his Orcs coming in 21st. Some of our other friends of the show, Herb Schaefer coming in 30th place, going off 4-2. Chase Enquist, who had an improbable run, he actually won his first 4 games, ended up dropping his last 2, finishing 4-2. Overall, 48th in the tournament. So another hats off to you, Chase. Nice job. We mentioned Henry, our local resident Tau player, coming in 56th place. And a couple of other friends also made the trip. Also great showing, well representing our local area. So overall, a really good show because got to see some old players kind of rise to the top, some of the perennial favorites, but also some new names in the top 8. Overall, pretty good tournament from a spectator standpoint. After the break, we'll go over next week's events, and hopefully there's an update to the ITC. I have to admit, right before the show, we double-checked, and the events from this past weekend have not been loaded. We'll do a quick refresh. We'll see you guys right after the break. Welcome back after the break. I want to thank Daniel once again for being on the show. He had a drop off at this late hour. Looking at the ITC rankings from this previous week, no changes from the previous week, as the results from SoCal Open have not been updated. So, Ray, what do we have going on next week in the ITC?
All right. We've got the Coast Clash at Coast Harbor in New South Wales. The Blood and Glory 40K GT at Roundhouse Derby in England. The Extra Life Ironman GT at Abu Games in Boise, Idaho. The Power 9 Games Warhammer 40K GT at Power 9 Games in North Las Vegas, Nevada. The Mid-Missouri Maelstrom at Ashland Optimus in Ashland, Missouri. The Cataclysm Clash of Champions at Cataclysm Games and Collectibles in McChesney Park, Illinois. There's the Steel City Showdown in Legions, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. The Armicon Stavanger Singles Championship in Silla, Rogaland. The Confusion ITC event in Muscle Shoals, Alabama. The Scottish Takeover 4 GT in Elgin, Scotland. And that looks to be about it.
That is quite a list. So lots to go over next week. So also more news as it's breaking. Hopefully some of the rumors that we've been hearing about Gene Steeler cults can finally be confirmed. There were some third-hand rumors about warlord traits and stratagems. If any of them are true, they will be a force to be reckoned with. Thank you for listening to the Exterminatus Podcast. My name's Eric.
I'm Raymond.
And I'm Don.
And thank you for listening to the Exterminatus Podcast.